right, thanks for listening while we took that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And yeah, we're going to get back to your host.
Aligned against our hegemony, and it's coming to an end whether we like it or not, and it's better for us to come to an end without having an enormous destruction of life and property and go transition to a better reality in the near future than to have to go through another massive war that they've been planning for centuries. They said, Pike said 1870 that there would be three world wars and that they would stage set all of them, and they did.
Hold on, Joe. Maybe we've got... They've had a power outage at the station. That's why we didn't hear the break. Not good, of course. So what we're going to do is persevere. I'm very, very pleased to have you here, Joe. What we've got to take place now has to do with the use of nukes and then the way in which the mini nukes were used to destroy the World Trade Center. You have a wonderful piece here about the development of nukes. Shall we begin there?
Yeah, just play a couple of minutes of it just to introduce people to it. We'll put a link down in the comment section so they can watch the full series. It's a 20-minute long video. It's really great.
Well, I'm willing to play the whole thing, Joe. We're good.
The destructive power of an atomic bomb is something that's almost difficult to even comprehend. An explosion that can destroy an entire city? What? Absolutely terrifying. And when the very first atomic bomb detonated over New Mexico during the Trinity test in 1945, the world was forever changed. The modern era had begun. But even the Trinity test, which was insane in itself, even that test was small compared to what future atomic explosions would be. By the 60s, we had bombs that were 1,000 times larger. I mean, it's truly insane. And that's what I want to talk about today. I want to talk about the evolution and timeline of atomic weapons. What was the first underwater test? The first underground test? What about the first test in space? We also have a record-holding blast yield chart. We're going to cover all the milestones, talk about all the big events in today's video on the evolution and history of the atomic bomb. We are starting our timeline back in 1945 with the first atomic test, the Trinity test. This test occurred on July 16th, 1945 at 5:29 a.m. local time at what was then the White Sands Proving Ground, just 40 miles southeast of Socorro, New Mexico. This was an atmospheric test with a blast yield of about 25 kilotons of TNT. The height of the mushroom cloud reached over 38,000 feet. The Trinity test was a culmination of the top secret Manhattan Project. The device itself looked like a metal sphere with wires attached to it, and it was referred to as the Gadget. This was also the first bomb to utilize the implosion plutonium design. Now, obviously, the Trinity test was the largest atomic bomb ever detonated, so it is indeed our first record holder. Less than a month later, on August 6th, the first use of an atomic bomb during wartime occurred over Hiroshima, Japan. The atomic bomb named Little Boy exploded with a yield of about 16 kilotons, all in all taking the lives of somewhere between 80 and 140,000 individuals. The Little Boy atomic bomb design was the first gun-type fission weapon and the first atomic bomb to only utilize uranium-235. Only a few days later, on August 9th, the city of Nagasaki would also be struck with an atomic bomb, taking the lives of 40 to 80,000 people. It is the last atomic bomb to ever be used during wartime. The bomb used over Nagasaki utilized the Mark III or Fat Man design, which was an implosion plutonium device based off of the first atomic bomb during the Trinity test. The Mark III Fat Man design was the first bulk-produced atomic bomb with 120 built. On September 2nd, 1945, World War II would come to an end, and surprisingly, the next nuclear bomb test wouldn't occur until almost a year later in the summer of 1946 with Operation Crossroads. The actual first post-war atomic bomb detonation was Crossroads Abel, which was also nicknamed Gilda. This occurred on June 30th, 1946, and utilized the Fat Man Mark III atomic weapon design. The blast yield was about 23 kilotons, and it was detonated about 600 feet above the water, 3.5 miles away from Bikini Atoll. Bikini Atoll is part of the Pacific Proving Grounds, one of several test sites that we will be discussing today. The second test of the Crossroads series was Baker, also about 23 kilotons. The Baker test was the first underwater atomic bomb, and the footage of the blast has become absolutely iconic. Many famous atomic bomb photos are of the Baker test.
Let's eat.
The bomb itself was about 90 feet underwater, attached to the USS LSM-60. The USS LSM-60 is this boat right here. No piece from the LSM-60 was ever recovered. Since this test was done underwater, the blinding light that you usually see from an atomic weapon cannot be seen. After Operation Crossroads came Operation Sandstone in 1948. This test was the first to occur at Eniwetok Atoll and also featured a new high yield record with Sandstone Yoke, which produced a yield of 49 kilotons on April 30th, 1946. So we have a new bomb to put on the list. Operation Sandstone was the first to be carried out by the Atomic Energy Commission, and their purpose was to test out a new bomb design. This would all lead to the development of the Mark IV nuclear bomb, the first mass-produced bomb with 550 made. 1945 to 1948 was kind of the golden age for the United States and their atomic testing. No other country had atomic bombs. They really had nothing to worry about. They were just trying different things, blowing up ships, because they were the sole nuclear power. But all of that would change in 1949. In 1949, the Soviet Union became the second country to successfully create an atomic explosion, and they would do so with RDS-1. RDS-1, aka First Lightning, or as the Americans refer to it, Joe-1, exploded on August 29, 1949, with a yield of 21 kilotons. This test was conducted at a remote test site in Kazakh SSR. The bomb design was very similar, one might say identical, to the Fat Man design, thanks to some Soviet espionage. The event would mark the beginning of the Cold War, a war that would last all the way up into the 90s. Many families in both the Soviet Union and the United States during the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s thought that maybe, you know, tomorrow won't come and they'll just be obliterated in the middle of the night. It's pretty scary. 1950, though, was a nice, relaxing year, as there were no atomic tests in 1950. However, 1951 would mark the first atomic test to occur over the continental United States since Trinity. Operation Ranger was a series of 5 bombs, and they were the first to be tested at the Nevada test site, specifically Area 5. The smallest test was Able, with only a 1 kiloton yield. The largest was 22 kilotons. Going back out to Eniwetok Atoll, at the Pacific Proving Grounds, we have another new major atomic milestone. The first atomic bomb with a yield of over 100 kilotons. In fact, make that over 200 kilotons. The test series Greenhouse had a specific test known as George that had an estimated yield of 225 kilotons. That's already way larger than the Trinity test, and we're not even close to how big it gets. This test was conducted on May 8, 1951, and was meant to test out a theoretical thermonuclear design, something we'll get to soon. Definitely a new record holder. So obviously we have two different test sites. We have the Nevada test site, NTS, and we had the Pacific Proving Grounds, which is part of the Marshall Islands. And you'll notice that the large, huge atomic bombs were all tested out at the Pacific Proving Grounds, and all the smaller, you know, 20 kiloton tests occurred at the Nevada test site. One would assume that would be for safety reasons. They didn't want massive 220 kiloton explosions over the continual United States in case there's some drift of whatever. So yeah, why not the middle of the Pacific? Towards the end of 1951, a new test series at the Nevada test site known as Operation Buster Jangle would be the first to feature armed soldiers. Perhaps you have seen the iconic footage of soldiers in trenches jumping out and walking towards a mushroom cloud. Definitely creepy vibes from this clip. Also during Operation Buster Jangle, the test Uncle was the first that was partially underground. So we had the USSR and the USA as the sole nuclear power all the way through 1951. However, we have a new country entering the Atomic Superpowers Club in 1952 with the United Kingdom and Operation Hurricane. Operation, the destructive...
Well, Joe, that's a wonderful history. And I know that there's so much to cover with the use of mini nukes on 9/11 that you're eager to initiate. We'll put a link to the sensational recording of the history of nukes. Would you like to say a few more words in a preface to the Palmer Report?
Yes. The United States conducted over 2,500 nuclear tests before they finally did a ban like in 1962. And the majority of those happened under Eisenhower's administration. But by 1950, we'd already developed the W-31 16-inch artillery shell, which had a range of 40 miles. And we deployed them on all four of our Iowa-class battleships in the number two turret. And we sent a notice to China that if they didn't stop attacking us in Korea, that we had the complete air superiority. We would set off of their Chinese ports and nuke every one of them with 15 kiloton, 16-inch diameter artillery shells. Compare that to the size of the little man and the fat boy, because this is exactly the amount of miniaturization that's gone into these weapons at a very, very early age. So that's what we're dealing with. And then as far as people saying there's no such thing as a nuclear bomb, I knew two people personally who were witnesses to atomic tests in the Pacific. They were sailors that were ordered to stand on the deck of the boats wearing nothing but welder's goggles and boxer shorts, and they monitored the amount of skin radiation that they got, and every one of them could testify, and all of their friends could testify that they could see the flash of light, which burnt their skin. They could feel the shock wave, and they could hear the sound wave after the explosion of these nuclear bombs, which was 20 miles away, could not have happened with anything additional. So now we can switch over to Netanyahu and his position on the World Trade Center building. In 1984, he was appointed to be the UN ambassador from Israel. And in 1986, he edited a book with 37 authors, and it was called Terrorism, How the West Can Win. And in that, several of the authors said that if the United States did not participate in international terrorism control, that the terrorists would destroy the World Trade Center building. And lo and behold, in February of 1993, the FBI stage set a bombing of the World Trade Center building. And my suspicion as an engineer was that they had monitored the building with a bunch of deflection gauges to find out how the building was going to react to the explosion in the basement in order to figure out if they were going to use conventional weapons or nuclear weapons, because they wanted to know what the harmonic frequency of the building, which amplifies the destructive capability of the explosives. The building had minor amount of damage. Trump inspected the building, and his structural engineer, who worked on all of his high-rise programs, went over there and inspected it. And then when World Trade Center happened, Trump said that interviewed the day after it happened, that his structural engineer said that bombs had been planted in the building. So we have him on tape in 2001, days after the event, saying that the buildings had been bombed. And we've got ample evidence of that. And you and I don't want to cover the stuff that we've already covered because we've got some new ground to break. But bottom line is, we were approached by Robert David Steele to do a memo to the president. And this was in July of 2018. And Robert David Steele had people inside the cabinet. He had two different people that he said could make sure that this memo was placed in front of the president. But he said, Trump will not read more than 800 words. So you have to be able to do less than two pages. And he won't look at anything that doesn't have a photo. So here's the report that I sent to him, Twin Towers Destroyed Using Clean Nukes, with a photo of the volcanic pyroclastic flow pouring out of the core of the building. And you and I have done a great one-hour discussion on the nuclear vaporization of that building. We had previously done a YouTube video on that, but we also had done YouTube interviews with a guy who claimed to be named Steve Diak, D-E-K-A or whatever his name was, who doesn't really matter. But bottom line is, he brought up some pretty important things, and I'd like to be able to elaborate on a little bit of those.
Go ahead, Joe.
Okay. This is from the FEMA 403 report, And this shows the exterior structure of the building. And I'll make sure I put a link to the FEMA 403.
That's the north. That's the north tower MBAC cutout, which appears to have been done from the inside out for a plane allegedly having hit the north tower, Joe. Yes.
Yes, this created the Roadrunner image on the outside of the building. Now, the different colors are three-story tall, what they call waffle panels, that were multi-column width, three columns width, and they had a 52-inch, the horizontal bands are 52-inch high, 2-inch thick plate steel that were welded to the exterior box columns, and then they were also welded to the inside floor joists. And so here's how the sections were connected to the floor joists. Again, in the FEMA 4032, I'll put the link to that in the comment section and also put a link to our previous interview where we discussed all of this information in depth. But here's the important point. We had a group of terrorists that were from Israel called the Gelatin Group that worked inside the building for at least 2 months, probably all three from the time that the lease was signed. And they had access to the floors, and the building was only 50% occupied, so they could go under floors, and they could work off hours, and they – go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Oh, okay. They could use plasma cutters to cut out the connections to the spandrel, which is on the exterior wall. Exterior wall, like I mentioned, has 52-inch high plate steel. These were splice-bolted between the spandrel sections of the different waffle panels and in-bolted between the vertical box columns on the outside. All of those bolts were cut prior to the building being demoed, along with all of the floor joists and bridging connections that were welded also to the outside wall. So they were able to come in, and what Steve Dick said is, here's a picture of one of those waffle panels laying on the ground at the St. John's Orthodox Church directly adjacent to the World Trade Center building. And he said, if you notice, none of the splice bolts on any of the three floors on either side of that panel had a elongation indicating that there was no shear along those lines because the bolts had already been cut and removed. And in addition to that, the end caps where the bolts would have held the box columns together had also been removed. And the panels themselves had deflection in the center, indicating that shape charges had been placed in those two panels to create the opening in the outside wall, which a lot of people refer to as the Roadrunner appearance. Now, the next thing is that this is World FTC Plate 16. This shows the exterior of the building. And if you see the two waffle panels that are blown out, you also see a sideways strike in the columns where that you can see that it was hit from a side angle that caused deflection of the box girders that were not blown out in order to create the appearance of wings. And that was probably from a missile that was direct.
Joe, if we're talking about the nukes, why are we talking about the plane hits? I want you to do the nukes. I don't want to hear about the plane hits.
Okay. Well, bottom line is, the next item that we had was that we had Judy Woods say that it was directed energy weapons, and directed energy weapons could not possibly have created the hole in the side of the building, number one. And number two, the burnt vehicles that she said outside were based on the flash of light and flash of nuclear energy that was coming up through the core of the building.
Joe, you're getting ahead of yourself. We don't need Judy Wood. We need to have the Palmer report.
Okay, well, let's get back to the Palmer report. Yes, excellent report. After I wrote an article at Veterans Today called Unequivocal 911 Nukes, I was contacted by one of my readers that said, you need to read the Palmer report. The Palmer report is 5,000 words. It had 45 PowerPoint slides and three 90-minute videos explaining what was going on. When I forwarded it to Veterans Today, Gordon Duff contacted me and said, man, these guys have independently proven everything that we've written in 80 articles at Nuclear Education posted at Veterans Day starting in April of 2014. And I'd read a dozen of those articles when you and I did our first interview on YouTube, and the title of our interview was Unequivocal 911 Nukes. So I wrote an article to explain that. I had previously met with Richard Gage in Austin in 2009 at the InfoWars DVD premiere, and I knew that it was controlled demolition, but I also knew it was impossible to do with thermite. I explained that in that particular article. I explained it also in the previous one-hour video that we discussed. We don't nearly need to go into that. But the important thing about the Palmer report is to scroll down to the slide, and I think I told you, yes, figure, no, not, that's not 215, figure 43.
Yeah, Jesus, Joe, I've got it all set up in sequence. Let's go through it slide by slide. We'll get there.
Okay.
Go ahead.
First of all, the building only had one continuous elevator, and that was in the center of the building, a freight elevator number 50, which went from the 6th floor basement up to the 110th floor, and that was the only one that was continuous, but adjoining it were the additional elevators. But they went had separations at the floors. So one of the things that needed to happen was they needed to blow out the sections between those transfer elevators that would make a continuous flow from the basement all the way up to the top of the building, so that when they blew the bomb off in the basement elevator number 50, that it would go up through the center and be able to expand out through the adjoining elevator shafts. The bomb was placed on the granite bedrock underneath the building. And we'll get to a little bit more detail on that when we get to the final excavation of the site.
Yes, here's the next. Go ahead, Joe.
Okay, here again, this shows the blast being directed up through the core of the building and how the radiation and the heat and light would be spread out through the building, vaporizing the core materials around the rest of the elevator shafts. And I had originally said that the elevator shafts were all concrete. That's a little bit incorrect. Most of the elevator shafts, in order to save money, had been built with sheetrock, which was very easy to vaporize. So that reduced the vaporization necessary. Go ahead.
Joe, let me just add a big picture here for our audience. The design of the Twin Towers was a novel tube within a tube design. The inner tube included the 47 massive core columns that provided the support for the higher floors. It was built with a safety factor of 20, which means that each floor was designed to hold 20 times the amount of load it was expected to carry. And then an external tube of 230 massive support columns made out of these waffle structures Joe has been describing, and then connected by the lattice structures, steel flooring connecting the inner tube to the outer tube that was covered by 4 to 8 inches of cement, which meant because the building were 288 feet on a side, each floor consisted of an acre of cement on a steel scaffolding. I mean, it was a massive 500,000-ton structure. And what Palmer discovered was they blew the inner tube from the bottom up, and then the outer tube was destroyed as a consequence of that effect, which Joe is now going to address in detail. Go ahead, Joe.
Yes, the building was 1,300 feet tall and 200 feet wide, so each side had 5 acres of area, and it was designed to withstand 120-mile-an-hour hurricane wind load, and they had 5 hurricanes that went between 1978, when the buildings were under construction, until they were destroyed in 2001, and they didn't break a pane of glass, so the building itself was very strong. Any claims that the buildings were just weak and fell down on their own, or that they'd been pre-wired for destruction, is absolutely bogus. Okay, let's go to the next slide. Yeah, this shows the initiation of the bomb. And what happened is the Manhattan had previously been covered with a 1,000-foot glacier during the last ice age. But at the start of the Holocene, 12,000 years ago, it started to melt. And as it melted, it dropped 40 feet of glacier till on top of the granite bedrock that was underneath the glacier and underneath the World Trade Center building. And so that glacial till was the only thing separating the granite from the 15-foot sea level of the Hudson River, and so they couldn't excavate down into the granite without having to explode it, and that would damage the retaining wall between them and the Hudson River and flood all of Manhattan. So the basement of the building was only 6 stories deep, built on solid granite, and they built a bathtub around it, which the bathtub was able to survive the explosion. And we'll get to that when we get down to the final number of slides. But bottom line is, granite bedrock underneath the building worked as a lens to force the nuclear blast up through the core of the building. And then it also worked as a damper to be able to form isotopes with all of the building material and the granite itself to be able to moderate the nuclear blast. Go ahead.
Joe, you have so much knowledge, and it's so detailed and specific. Let me emphasize the key role of the bathtub. This is like a moat or a dike that was built to prevent Hudson River water from flooding beneath the Twin Towers. If that were to happen, it would have, you know, undermined the most valuable real estate in the world, flooded the bath train tunnels connecting, you know, New Jersey to New York and all that. So they had to devise an ingenious technique that would destroy the Twin Towers without damaging the bathtub. Now, that required a lot of ingenuity, and that's why it's so complex. Joe, continue.
Yes, and the bathtub was undamaged by the blast and the destruction of both of those buildings. It shows
it suffered minor damage, but not sufficient to bring about the flooding. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, and there's ample photos of the construction of the building, and they had equipment sitting directly on that bedrock, which we'll get to when we get down to the final slide in this series. But let's go ahead. This shows the blast coming up through the core of the building. And like you said, when you vaporize all of the core columns and all of the core elevator shafts, they were what was supporting each floor on all four sides, and that would cause the floor to fall. The floors were connected to the walls, so when the floor fell on the floor below it, what would happen is it would start to pull the walls in from all four sides. And then as those walls fell, that would form a collapse. And that would form a triangular squish area between the center core, which no longer existed, and the exterior wall, which was being collapsed from the weight of the walls above it falling down on top of the floors. And that would provide these squib lines that Richard Gage says indicated massive coordinated thermite bombs on every individual floor at every column, which would be physically impossible to do. That was actually being blown out. The windows were being blown out. The squib lines are being blown out from the compression of the air that was between the floors as the walls fell and created these triangular sections.
Joe, let me check, see if we're back online again. I just need to know. I think we're not, but there it is, you know. Joe, we're just going to persevere. We seem not to be going out live, I'm really sorry to say, but we just have to cope with the situation we're in, alas. It's allegedly due to the weather. I think it's something other than that. I think what we're reporting is so important they don't want it to go out to the public and that we are being sabotaged. My take. Go ahead, Joe. Here we have the next.
Highly possible. Yeah, the previous slide was figure number 6-25. And what's important there is it shows that as this nuclear bomb was burning, it was melting a hole down into the granite, which we'll get to in a later slide. But bottom line is, next to it, it says additional option. It shows carbon being hit by gamma rays, which are causing release of beryllium and helium. Well, I thought that was really interesting because they said that iron has four stable isotopes. And I've been studying radiation for a very long time. And so I said, well, gosh, if iron has four stable isotopes, how many radioactive isotopes does it have? Oh, it has 24. Oh, well, that's kind of interesting. Well, what are the other elements that make up a steel and concrete building? Well, you have calcium, and you have carbon, and you have silicon. Those are the components that are used to make up concrete. And you have carbon and calcium, which carbon and
iron, which make up steel. And bottom line is, iron has 4 stable isotopes, 24 radioactive isotopes. Carbon has 2 stable and 13 radioactive isotopes. Calcium has 5 stable and 21 radioactive isotopes. And silicon has 3 stable and 20 radioactive isotopes. So as these gamma rays are flowing up through the center of the building, the very materials that the building is made of are absorbing the gamma rays so that you don't get a giant gamma ray explosion outside of the building shell. But what you're doing is you're converting the basic elements of the building into radioactive isotopes that have an average half-life of 90 days, and the basement of the building stayed 2,500 degrees hot with 24-hour, 24/7 spraying of fire water on top of the building until December. And you didn't do that with thermite, and you didn't do that with directed energy weapons.
Go on.
Okay, let's just kind of forward through, and you can see how the building starts to collapse on itself and pulls itself down because the whole core of the building had been eaten out by this nuclear bomb.
Well, and yet when it's over, Joe, there's no pile of debris, unlike Building 7, which came down in a classic controlled demolition, where we know from experience that the debris pile from a classic controlled demolition equals about 12% of the original height. In that case, 47 floors, 12%, 5.5. That's what we had with Building 7. But compared with Building 1 and 2, nothing. Even Father Frank Morales from St. Mark's Episcopal Church, who was a first responder, came on my shows twice and reported the buildings were destroyed to or even below ground level, when 12% of 110 floors meant there should have been 13.5 floors of debris for each. It wasn't there because it had not been a classic controlled demolition. It had been a demolition under control, but nuclear, that basically converted the materials, the concrete and the steel, into very fine dust. Pick up.
Yes, and this. Okay, back up to that particular slide because it shows an important thing. I think this is the South Tower.
Yeah.
The top of the tower, over 22 degrees from normal. And I was watching this live on TV, and this is when I got my first clue that this was bullshit. The tower leaned over 22 degrees. As an engineer, I said, well, you got compression on one side, tension on the other. The tension side will fail. The compression side will compress. And the building, the top 20 floors of the building will topple over, hit the side of the building, and it will slide down the side and land on the ground. That is not what happened. What happened is as the core of the building was eaten out, it started pulling the building back upright, and then it started falling down on its own. And so I knew on 911, the moment that the South Tower fell and it had that deflection, that this was a controlled demolition. And I had been spending the last 23 years, investigating this. 1,000 hours a year for every one of those years. So bottom line is, I know exactly what happened. And we'll scroll down to the next couple of slides.
Yeah, well, what's interesting about that tilting is even Steve Jones, who was promoting the nanothermite theory, said when the building started to tilt, all of a sudden, poof, it was destroyed and converted into, you know, along with the rest of the building, millions of cubic yards of very fine dust, which, of course, as you well know, is a signature of the use of nuclear devices. But even Steve Jones, who was advocating nanothermite, couldn't explain it. And that's because it cannot be explained in terms of nanothermite, so that he was talking about a refutation of the theory he would advocate. That eventually led to a parting of the ways, because I never bought into the nanothermite theory. Just as you observe, I would eventually publish 3 articles about it with T. Mark Hightower, a chemical engineer, explaining how in order to destroy concrete, you require a detonation velocity of 3,200 meters per second. In order to destroy steel, a detonation velocity of 6,100 meters per second. But the highest attributed detonation velocity with nanothermite was only 895 meters per second, meaning nanothermite isn't even powerful enough to destroy concrete, much less steel, Joe. It's all just a pile of happy horse shit.
Yes, well, bottom line is you cannot reach the vaporization of steel with thermite either, and that's the next problem, and you can do that very easily with a nuclear blast. So in addition to having a shockwave that exceeds the detonation velocity of steel, you also had a heat wave that exceeds the vaporization temperature. And when you vaporize steel in a building that has an aluminum sheeting on the exterior of the building, according to architects and engineers for 911 Truth, had 2,200 tons of aluminum on as a protective on the exterior of the building so they didn't have to paint them to do maintenance. Bottom line is when you vaporize aluminum, which vaporizes at even lower temperature, and you vaporize steel, you're going to form nano thermite particles in the air just from the combination of the steel and aluminum molecules.
So yes, yes.
You're making thermite, and any thermite that you find in the dust samples was not combusted during the demolition of the buildings because thermite is not a catalyst. It's a reactant, and any thermite that's used to use in welding or cutting is not available afterwards as thermite.
Joe, this is such an important point, such an important point. Namely, that little droplet that were used by Steve Jones and others to promote the nanothermite theory are a causal effect of the nuclear with the interaction between the aluminum colliding and the steel as it's being vaporized. In other words, there were predictable outcomes of the use of nuclear devices. And let me add, Joe, Steve Jones is an expert in nuclear devices. So Steve Jones, in my opinion, had to know better. So I'm very, very troubled to have been forced to that conclusion that the man I made the co-chair of Scholars for 9/11 Truth when I founded it in December of 2005 actually was an expert in promoting what I regard as a limited hangout to nanothermite theory, which, as I've explained, cannot possibly explain the data. In fact, just to illustrate its absurdity, Niels Harrit, who was an associate professor at the University of Chemistry at the University of Copenhagen, emeritus, when asked how much nanothermite it would take to destroy a twin tower, he said 29,000 metric tons. 29,000 metric tons of nanothermite to destroy a tower, Joe. I mean, how absurd is that?
Yes, on their misinformation publication that they put out with one of their DVDs, the architects and engineers for 911 Truth said that it takes 0.13 pounds of thermite to melt each pound of steel. Well, if you're missing 100,000 pounds of steel, tons of steel, how many tons of thermite? Exactly. Yeah, they've absolutely proven themselves to be relaying false information if they can't even do the basic physics involved in that calculation.
Yeah, it's deliberate obfuscation, Joe. I mean, this is misleading the public about a monster event that occurred right here in New York City. They don't want the public to know, which I believe is part and parcel of why we have a weather interference with a broadcast today. Here's more, Joe. Notice how the effects you see externally to the destruction from the bottom up of the inner core leads to the destruction of the outer core, or the inner tube leads to the destruction of the outer tube, which is what the public only witnessed. They weren't able to observe the destruction of the inner tube from the bottom out. And then when you had the Harley guy come on, Joe, and start talking about, oh, well, you know, the heat from the fires must have melted the steel and caused it to collapse, and promoted the idea of a collapse when it's not a collapse. It's blowing apart in every direction from the top down. All the floors remain stationary. In a collapse, they would have moved. You got the conversion of the building into millions of cubic yards of very fine dust, and when it's over, there's nothing there. Joe, this is wonderful. Palmer going through Palmer. I think our audience will want to do that again and again.
Yes, and one of the things that I've been studying for a very, very long time, I took geology in college, and I always wondered what volcanism was caused by. Earth has 259
billion cubic miles of mostly molten rock. And that rock is molten because one part per million is uranium and two parts per million is thorium. And uranium has a half-life of 4 billion years. And so all of the thorium that we have on the planet is burnt up uranium that we had when the planet was originally formed, which meant that we had even more of it warming the core of the planet, which is why there was no life on the planet for the first billion years, because it was still cooling off from the nuclear decay that was inside. And absolutely 100% proof that volcanoes are a fission reaction from the planet's ability to be able to do fractional distillation and smelting of elements inside the crust, and that's what causes volcanic flow. And if you look at these buildings, they look exactly like a volcano with the pyroclastic flow blowing out and then covering the whole area with volcanic dust. Absolutely absurd. This is the only way possible to discuss the destruction of the Twin Towers, and they don't want to discuss this because this means that it had to be a state action, and to be a state action, it had to involve a state that had nuclear weapons. Gee, maybe the folks over there at Mossad, and it had to involve the duplicity of everybody in the DOD, the CIA, and the FBI, because the FBI managed to cover up this every way possible.
You're absolutely right, Joe. That's the reflection of the corruption of our government under Bush and Cheney, which is why they had to steal the election to bring in Bush and Cheney in order to bring us in 2000, in order to bring us 9/11, where Dick Cheney, according to Michael Rupert, with whom I agree in his book Crossing the Rubicon, was the on-ground executive director of 9/11 from a bunker beneath the White House. Outrageous.
And then here again, this particular Palmer report has 3 90-minute videos, and the videos go slide by slide doing the same thing that James and I are discussing. The only problem was the physicists that put this together, four of them with PhD, two from Germany, one from Denmark, and one from France. And I've debated two of those guys on our Revolution radio program previously. But bottom line is, they didn't understand much about construction, and they also didn't understand much about nuclear radiation outside of the bomb effect. So after I published, I sent the Palmer report to Gordon Duff, and he published it at Veterans Today as Breathtaking Solving Nuclear 911. And after I reread the report and I realized that some of the things that they were talking about were incorrect, I wrote an additional report that we put up at Veterans Day called Exposing 911, the NIST Jenga Game. And this goes into the various isotopes that we previously discussed, along with the construction abnormalities that they didn't manage to mention in their report. The bottom line is, we've done all the research to prove exactly what happened.
Very, very good, Joe. I think this is just sensational. You know, I like hearing how they use their smaller explosion to weaken the building, because you had firefighters saying they heard boom, 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 and that's what they were hearing, those smaller explosions. More.
And they also use thermite cutting charges on the base, on the lower portions of the building, in order to direct the columns to fall in on themselves. These buildings, these exterior box columns were built out of plate steel, and they were cut at a 45-degree angle, which is not a normal failure plane for a sheet steel that was built in rectangular sections. So those obviously had been planted with cut charges to cut the columns to force them to slide down on each other into the core of the building.
Yeah, fascinating, Joe, fascinating. You have the horizontal pyroclastic flow of the radioactive dust dispersion. You know, I mean, all Manhattan was just covered with, 2 inches of this dust that the U.S. Geological Survey would study and find elements that would not have been present had it not been a nuclear event. Here we get toasted cars, Joe. Please elaborate.
Yes, that's what I was mentioning about the exterior of the building. Because of the construction of the steel, it formed a grid, and that forms what's called a waveguide. And when you have a nuclear reaction going off and it's going through a waveguide, it will present outside the building just the striped panels in the vacant areas between the steel. So you would have a car where the front half of the car would be burnt and the alloy wheels would be vaporized, but the back of the car, the paint wouldn't even be blistered on. And that's why a certain PhD mechanical engineer said that it was directed energy weapons, even though the amount of energy necessary to do that would be enormous, number one. And number two, the placement of the directed energy weapons would be impossible. You couldn't do it remotely from a surface area like she claimed was done over in Brooklyn. I think it was the Bronx. She said that, yeah, that was set from a tower that was in a military base. Well, there was buildings in the way. You couldn't possibly have been able to direct the full energy all the way down to the basement level of this building, number one. And number two, you couldn't have done it with satellites because it would have taken enormous, it would take more electrical generation than the United States produced probably in 2 or 3 days to be able to vaporize those buildings using directed energy weapons. So the whole thing is absolutely preposterous. But there again, she's a limited hangout in order to get a bunch of people that are, you know, groupie followers that go, well, that's what happened because nobody wants to talk about Judy Woods because she's right. And it's like, no, she's not. And neither is Richard Gage. And neither is anybody else that's been able to discuss this stuff.
Except, of course, for veterans today, you, me, scholars for 9/11 truth, others who have pursued this to the bitter end. Here's more. Steve Jones liked to cite that photo in the upper left. That's in fact from Architects and Engineers, Joe. Comment.
Well, I want to get to the slide. I think it's 43 that shows the crater that was left underneath the building.
We'll get there, Joe.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah. Bottom line is everything is consistent with everything that I've learned as a structural engineer taking classes in 1970s and having 50 years of practice and being registered 40 years, that everything that we are talking about today is entirely consistent with all of the empirical evidence and all of the education and the lifelong training that I've taken at a college professor's level to understand everything possible about our reality, which includes history, but also science, and in particular, science of engineering and astronomy and geology. So, yeah, this shows a photo of the debris field at the end of the project. And what's important to note in this one is directly in the upper left-hand corner is a seven-story building with a crater in the center of the building. That's World Trade Center 6.
Right.
And it was not hit by a plane, but it has a crater that goes all the way down to the basement. And in the basement, there was supposedly $1 billion dollars worth of gold that was stored. And there was truck prints on the ground outside of it indicating that a large truck had come in and removed all of the gold prior to the vaporization of that building. And I invite people to study that photo and explain to me how that was done by thermite and how it was also done by directed energy weapons, or was it possible that they just put a small mini nuke in the basement of that building and blew the core of it out just exactly like a rectangular volcano?
Very nice. Huh. Joe, that's what we have here. Am I missing one of the slides? Can you show it if you wanted to show, you know, the way the excavation, how it got down to the granite that had been carved out during the Ice Age? I can make you host and you can show any additional images you want.
I don't have it where I can screen share, but I think it's slide number 6-43. Of the Palmer Report. It's the next to last slide.
Well, let me see if I can find it, Joe. This is going to be a little tricky. Wait. Keep talking while I'm looking for it.
Bedford's website, look it up. Mine is, they show the building after they managed to get the 2,500 degree hot nuclear decay out, put out.
they started excavating all of the steel, and all of that steel was shipped over to a landfill called Fresh Kill outside of New York, and that was used as a dumping site for slaughterhouses previously. But when they offshored all of that particular meat processing to other locations in the country, then it just was an abandoned site, and they put all of the steel there. They took it under police guard so that the truck drivers couldn't even stop and grab a sandwich or a cup of coffee. They left directly from the World Trade Center site to Fresh Kill, where it was loaded onto freighters and shipped to China so it could be melted so that they wouldn't have any proof of all of the available isotopes for the iron that had still been left in the residue of the building. So were we able to pull up slide 43?
No, I couldn't find it, Joe. I'm sorry to say.
Yeah, well, it might have been taken down at this point. Okay, here's what was available when this was originally posted at Veterans Today. And that original post at Veterans Today was September 1st, 2019. And I urge people to go there because in addition to having all the other reference material, Gordon Duff listed 80 nuclear education articles, all linked in the bottom of the bibliography for that particular thing. Those are not in later republications of this. And the other day, about a month ago, I was reviewing the thing, and under the photo of the construction site, which is the plate number 43, somebody had placed on there a glacier melt hole underneath the building exposed with the excavation of the steel. And I sent that to Gordon. I said, what the hell? And he said, oh, my God, somebody's hacked our site and put this disclaimer on there. And that's to indicate that the building was not built on flat granite like all the construction photos show, but it had a 150-foot deep hole underneath the building. And if you look at the slide that was originally posted, on the September 1st, 2019 Veterans Today site, and they've moved their site to an Iceland facility, and he said that it's pretty much hack-proof, but they still managed to get hacked. Bottom line is they show construction workers down inside there with metamorphic rock, which indicates that it was extremely high temperature, and they excavated all the steel that was sitting down inside that hole, but above the hole on the top granite level were three-story tall track hose, giant caterpillar-style back hose that are on tracks that were pulling the material out of the building, and they had people down there spraying it off and sealing any possible cracks so that they could come back and cover it up. But bottom line is, if you read the Palmer Report and you listen to what Jim and I are talking about today, you get a complete understanding of exactly what happened to the World Trade Center buildings. And as an engineer, I'm particularly offended that the American Society of Civil Engineers has never made a statement on this. Richard Gage says he's disappointed the architects, American Institutes of Architects, AIA, have not made a statement on this. The Steel Institute, which is responsible for helping write the steel codes, and the American Concrete Institute, none of them have made statements, and none of the building codes, the uniform and international building codes that are used nationwide, have had any revisions as far as structural design based on these three cataclysmic failures on 9-1-1 of World Trade Center 1, 2, and 7.
Joe, terrific. I mean, you know, Building 7 is the tell in relation to 1 and 2. I mean, architects and engineers has got a lot of mileage over showing endlessly that Building 7 was brought down by a classic controlled demolition. All the supports are blown at the same time. All the floors come down at the same time, roughly at the speed of free fall. When it's over, there's a stack of debris equal to 5.5 floors. Why didn't they then contrast that with the effects of the Building 1 and 2, which are blowing apart in every direction from the top down? Not true of Building 7. All the floors remain stationary. Not true of Building 7. Being converted into millions of cubic yards of very fine dust. Not true of Building 7. And then when it's over, no stack of debris. Unlike Building 7, there should be 13.5, but it ain't there. Joe, I got to tell you, I mean, Architects and Engineers is, in my opinion, provably a limited hangout. And I say the same of Judy Wood. I've made this point many, many times, that they were introduced to deliberately confuse the public so it wouldn't know the difference. And would you believe, neither Judy Wood nor Architects and Engineers are willing to talk about who was responsible and why. Only scholars have explained this was an Israeli op. You began talking about that book, Terrorism, How the West Can Win, published 1987. How can they talk about if there's going to be a terrorist attack on the United States that it would be targeting specifically the World Trade Center unless that was their plan all along? And it turns out that Bibi Netanyahu, who is a personal friend of Larry Silverstein, to whom the World Trade Center was sold just 6 weeks before the event, and he immediately fired the security firm that had been looking after since it first opened in 1907 and hired an Israeli firm. And he renegotiated his insurance contract to include an anti-terrorist clause. And because there were ostensibly two different planes, he claimed two different attacks, double indemnity, pocketing over $4.5 billion on a $114 million investment. They don't call him Lucky Larry for nothing, Joe.
Yes, in addition to meeting Richard Gage at the four-hour-long BBD event in May of 2009 in Austin, I also attended two events here in Houston with Richard Gage that were also two-hour-long BBDs, and I made a public statement in each one of those saying that there was ample evidence that it was involved. Thurman went to dinner with Richard afterwards, and then last April 2nd, he had an event in Austin, and I was up in Austin for an event with the Medical Freedom Movement on Saturday. So I went to his event on Sunday, sat there for 3 hours and listened to his presentation and discussed with him other elements. And then I've got him on as a guest with you and I talking about this on a BitChute channel, and we could put a link to that. But I didn't want to tear into him too bad because I kind of respect some of what they did. And then we also, later following that, got him to agree to be interviewed on TNT radio. And he said, well, I can only talk for an hour. And I said, well, since you're going to only talk for an hour, I'll have the whole second hour to do rebuttal. So I'm not going to interrupt you at all. And so after the first hour, he said, well, I can stay for an extra 30 minutes. And I said, well, I can hold any rebuttal for the final 30 minutes, too. I want to say that they've done some really good work. One of the things they did was hire a structural engineering professor from the University of Alaska Fairbanks named Leroy Halsey. He did a finite element analysis on the World Trade Center building, and they spent $250,000 having him and two Chinese graduate students because no American student would work on the program, even though all of them were very interested in it. They said it would be career-ending for us. The Chinese guys can go back to China and still have a career, but I can't be involved in it. So he produced a, I think it's an hour and a half, two-hour-long documentary about the failures of NIST and their hypothesis. And there again, there's a NIST 403, I think, or maybe it's 405, on World Trade Center 7. And it shows how that building was built, and it shows all the additional information. So that's bottom line what happened there. But what they do in their finite element analysis is that they prove that NIST was NIST hypothesis of a overheated column sliding off of the haunch that it was sitting on caused the whole building to collapse. And they are able to prove that NIST is 100% wrong on that, but they don't advance on a hypothesis on how it happened. And there again, Richard Gage was prohibited by his organization rules from stating who was the actual person involved in this. Well, problem with him is the same thing that James O'Keefe had with Project Veritas. He had some people that came to him and said, you're not capable of managing this organization by yourself and doing all your own investigative reporting and your own videos. You need to have a group of board of directors. And so he hired on some people as board of directors. One of them was one of the people who provided a report for Robert David Steele. The memo that we previously mentioned, that was Barbara Honecker. And I met her when you and I met
at the JFK conference, and I had laminated color copies of my articles about the 911 nukes, and she goes, no, that's not what happened. You can't tell me what happened. Well, basically, her and the group that was installed leveraged Richard Gage out of directorship of the group that he founded and had over 3,000 architects with, in order to make sure that nobody was going to be able to discuss the foreign connection and the actual cause of that. And they came up with various excuses why they did that. But bottom line is, they forced him out the same way that James O'Keefe was forced out at Project Veritas. But he has since been able to expand his dialogue since he's out on his own. And he's now actually starting to say. So that's a good thing. And the other thing that spun off from his group is lawyers for 911 Truth. And they've been putting lawsuits out and been promised that there would be grand jury investigations since 2018 on the part of SDNY. And we know that SDNY, like every other branch of the Department of Injustice, is not intent on finding any justice. And so there's never been a single witness called. But there's other trials that are going on. Particularly, there's one coming out of England of a guy that was a victim of this, where they have laws that they can actually be able to compel and subpoena testimony. And so bottom line is, hopefully we'll put enough information out with today's program that people will be able to understand what really happened. And once you understand the enormous amount of planning and the enormous amount of weapon details that were required to demolish all four of the buildings that were destroyed that day, then you will be able to see that this is 100% a state action, that it wasn't 29 guys with box cutters. And the FBI covered up the arrest of Zakaris Massari by FBI agents Dean Rolette and Harry Sammet, which would have proven that this was not a conspiracy by a bunch of cavemen with box cutters.
Joe, since we have the opportunity, I'd like to finish that history of the development of nukes. I thought it was simply excellent. Let me see if I can find about where we were to continue.
The destructive power of an atomic bomb is something that's almost difficult to even comprehend. An power of fusion run a club in 1952 with the United Kingdom in Operation Hurricane. Operation Hurricane was conducted at Montebello Islands in Western Australia on October 2nd and had a yield of 25 kilotons. There were now three nuclear powers, but only a month later, the U.S. would be entering the second generation, a new tier of nuclear weapons, the first thermonuclear device. So what the heck is that? Well, a thermonuclear bomb, also referred to as a hydrogen bomb or H-bomb, utilizes the power of fusion rather than fission. Just know that, like, this is a whole new level of bomb. We don't talk about kilotons when we talk about thermonuclear bombs. We talk about megatons. One megaton is 1,000 kilotons. The first successful thermonuclear test came on November 1st, 1952 with Operation Ivy Test Mike. Ivy Mike was detonated over Eniwetok Atoll and had an estimated blast yield of 10 megatons. 10 megatons. 10,000 times larger than that one kiloton explosion we talked about earlier. Yeah, definitely our new record holder. The pure fission bombs weren't done yet. In fact, the largest U.S. fission bomb ever detonated occurred a couple weeks later on November 16th with Ivy King. This Gen 1 pure fission bomb had a yield of 500 kilotons. The Soviets were quick to join the second generation of thermonuclear weapons, as less than a year later, on August 12, 1953, they conducted RDS-6, also known as JOE-4 here in the U.S. However, the blast yield wasn't very impressive for a second generation atomic bomb, as it only had a blast yield of 400 kilotons, still easily enough to destroy a city. Going back out to the Nevada test site, we have the first tactical nuclear warhead shot from a cannon, aka our first atomic artillery device. This was a 280mm artillery-fired atomic projectile. This was part of Operation Upshot Not Hole, and the shot itself was Gravel, which occurred on May 25th, 1953. Similar to Operation Buster Jangle, Upshot Not Hole involved over 21,000 soldiers. This test again came with some pretty iconic footage. Textbook mushroom cloud right here. A year later, on March 1st, 1954, we have a new high-yield blast record with Operation Castle Test Bravo. Castle Bravo had an estimated blast yield of 15 megatons. Absolutely insane. And it was actually quite surprising to have such a high blast yield because they only expected somewhere between 7 and 8 megatons. Unfortunately, due to this high blast yield and an unpredictable weather pattern, the fallout from Castle Bravo actually spread over the Marshall Islands and caused over 90 injuries. And unfortunately, would take the life of a radio man on a Japanese ship known as Fifth Lucky Dragon. The controversies behind this test, as well as other tests over the Pacific Proving Grounds, was actually the inspiration behind Godzilla. Speaking of Godzilla and pop culture, perhaps you are familiar with the Call of Duty map Nuketown. Well, that's inspired by the next operation on our timeline, Operation Teapot. Operation Teapot had a shot named Apple II that occurred on May 5th, 1955. Apple II was intended to test various building construction types in an atomic blast. All the tests from Apple II were actually made into a documentary made by the Federal Civil Defense Administration called Operation Q, and it was released to the public. You know, to give them an idea of what it would be like. Definitely an iconic test. The next test actually occurred 500 miles off the coast of San Diego, California with Operation Wigwam. This was the first deep water test, and it was meant to research how vulnerable submarines are to underwater nuclear blasts. The blast itself was about 30 kilotons at a depth of 2,000 feet. So we talked about the first Soviet thermonuclear bomb, RDS-6, earlier. Well, now we come to the first true Soviet thermonuclear bomb, the Soviets' first bomb in the megatons. RDS-37 had 1.6 megatons and was tested on November 22, 1955. It was highly inspired by the U.S.'s Castle Bravo test. Unfortunately, two people were killed in this atomic test, a soldier in a trench below and a little girl who was in a building over 40 miles away. Check out this footage from a town 45 miles away. This is one of my favorite pieces of atomic footage because it kind of gives you like a real-world example of what it would be like to be in a situation like this. It just looks so eerie off in the distance, and then several minutes later, the blast wave finally catches up to you. We are now moving forward to 1957, back in the United States, with the controversial Operation Plumb Bob. Can't quite say that. Operation Plumb PB is notable for having the largest nuclear weapon ever tested over the continual U.S. with the shot Hood. This was at 74 kilotons and occurred on July 5th, 1957. Also with Operation PB, we have the first fully underground test with the shot Rainier, which was on September 19th. The bomb was only 1.7 kilotons, but it was still enough to be detected by cimologists all around the world. We have a third country joining the thermonuclear club with the United Kingdom on November 8, 1957. The test Grapple X was conducted over Christmas Island. The blast yield was 1.8 megatons, which I guess is spelled differently in UK English. However, their largest yield ever was from Grapple Y, which occurred on April 28, 1958. And had an estimated yield of 3 megatons. After this test, the Brits and the Americans actually joined forces with the 1958 US-UK Mutual Defense Agreement. This allowed the British to test their atomic weapons at the Nevada test site, which they did 24 times. It's time to go up to the very first high atmospheric test, which came with Operation Hardtack 1 Shot Teague at 76.8 kilometers above the Earth's surface. And this was with a massive 3.8 megaton atomic bomb. Technically, this is upper atmosphere. It's not a true space atomic test, but that would come with Operation Argus and Argus 1, conducted 200 kilometers above the Earth's surface, but this only had a yield of 1.7 kilotons. Towards the end of 1958, we entered a limited test ban treaty between the USSR and the USA. This occurred between 1958 and 1961. Do you know who didn't participate in the limited test ban treaty? Well, that would be France, who tested their first atomic bomb on February 13, 1960 with Operation Gerboy Bleu. This was done over in French Algeria and had a yield of 70 kilotons. So, of course, we did have that limited test ban treaty that we were talking about earlier. That was about to end, and the Soviet Union really wanted to flex on just the world. And they would do so on October 30th, 1961, with the massive Tsar Bomba, which had an estimated magnitude of 52 to 60 megatons. Truly insane. In fact, the bomb itself was rated for 100 megatons. This is the largest atomic bomb ever detonated. So it is the final member on our list. Here's what it looks like compared to the Trinity test. I mean, absolutely mind-boggling. This was done way up here on this Long Island above the Soviet Union. Following the massive Tsar Bomba, the U.S. conducted the very first all-underground test with Operation Nougat, which occurred between 1961 and 1962. This test would be a precursor to what would become the norm in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. The first atomic handheld rocket launcher would also come in 1962. This little handheld rocket launcher was called the Davy Crockett. Also with Operation Sunbeam came the smallest nuclear bomb ever with Little Feller 1, which occurred on July 17th, 1962. This was also the last atomic bomb atmospheric test over the continual U.S. Back out in the ocean, we go to the first ICBM test, and that was Frigate Bird of Operation Dominique on May 6, 1962. This was the first and only ICBM test with an active warhead. A pretty massive warhead, too, as it had a yield of 700 kilotons. Finally, we come to Operation Fishbowl, which had the largest atomic bomb ever detonated in outer space. The test Starship Prime had 1.4 megatons, and it exploded over 400 kilometers above the Earth's surface. Also with Operation Fishbowl came the final U.S. atmospheric atomic test. This was a test tightrope, and it was conducted on November 4th, 1962. In 1963, everything with atomic testing would change with the Partial Test Ban Treaty. This prohibited any signing nation from testing atomic bombs except for those conducted underground. There was one notable nation that did not sign this treaty, and that is, of course, China, who conducted their first test on October 16th, 1964. Their first test was titled 596. And 3 years later, they would conduct their first thermonuclear test with test number 6 that occurred on June 17th, 1967. Following the limited test ban treaty, the U.S. conducted Operation Storax, which actually looked into finding non-war uses for atomic bombs. So perhaps, you know, could you use an atomic bomb for mining or for creating a large hole in the ground, which is exactly what they did with the test Sedan. Sedan is by far the largest crater at the Nevada test site. The Russians did something very similar and created a large crater themselves. However, theirs actually filled up with the water and turned into a lake known as Lake Changan. So the 60s and 70s and 80s were kind of a lot of nothing, just a lot of underground tests. There were a few notable tests that we should discuss, though. On November 6, 1971, Operation Grommet Test Kanakin was the largest underground nuclear explosion ever at 5 megatons. Another event worth mentioning was the very last atmospheric test ever, at least to this day in 2023, and that was from China on October 16th, 1980. Another notable operation was the first joint Soviet-U.S. test with Operation Touchstone in 1988. And finally, the last U.S. test was Shot Divider of Operation Doolin on September 23rd, 1992. After this test, the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty would go in effect, and this would ban all atomic tests from all the signing nations. Here's a list of every nation who has tested an atomic weapon, including both a fission bomb, a fusion bomb, and the last time they tested one. It's possible that China may have conducted an atomic test in 2020, although it has not been confirmed, and that's a little sketch. So yeah, atomic bombs, they're scary. Thanks for watching. We'll see you in the next video.
Joe, I gotta say, I think that was simply excellent. I'm so pleased you had us include that today, and I'm glad we had the opportunity to complete it. That was only because we've been knocked off of Revolution Radio, sad to say. Joe, your further thoughts about all of the above?
Yes, well, one thing he didn't mention was that in order to produce a hydrogen bomb, you had to have a source of hydrogen, and they were originally using deuterium, which is heavy water, which is hydrogens with a neutron, so it's a heavier atom, but it was really hard to isolate that. And then they came up with the Teller-Ulam process, where they said, look, if we just include lithium, when you break a lithium molecule, you'll end up getting six hydrogens. And when you get those six hydrogens, they can fuse to form three helium. And that's exactly what you have in the way of a hydrogen bomb, which gives you magnitudes increase of the amount of explosive yield based on the amount of fissionable material you have in the initial part of the bomb. So that's item number one. Item number two, Eisenhower was so convinced that nuclear weapons were the best thing that ever happened that he had a thing called Operation Plowshare, where they blew up a mountain in order to create a pass for a roadway here in America, and I think out in the Nevada area. And then he went to, they said, well, we're getting a lot of fallout from this, and we're doing a lot of nuclear testing, and the downwinders are getting sick, so maybe we shouldn't be doing this. So then he said, well, I think we could do ports and we could do canals like the Panama Canal. We could blow a whole new Panama Canal somewhere down in Central America. So they went up to Alaska. They found a little village, and they managed to convince the Eskimos that they needed, or Inuits, whichever they prefer to be called today. But bottom line is, they said, if you move away from here, we'll blow a bomb up that will create a nice natural harbor and give you guys a great source of income and be able to import and export stuff from your new harbor. So they moved them away. They blew a giant hole in the coastline of Alaska. It was so radioactive that when they came back, they weren't even able to settle there. And nobody's ever used that, quote, Eisenhower port. So that's a little bit of an issue right there.
Surely the residual radioactivity was predictable in advance, Joe. I mean, this is very insulting, if you ask me.
And then to just keep things up to current stuff, this just came in from the International Center for 911 Justice. 911 family vows to keep fighting for a new inquest after the Attorney General in the UK denies them.
I'll be off the air in 15. I'll call you. Yeah, go ahead, Joe. Go ahead.
So bottom line is, where there was an outside chance that the UK was going to allow hearings to discuss what really happened on 911, the UK Attorney General says, oh, no. We can't let the plebs know how the ruling class is actually doing everything we can to destroy them. Every war that we've had has been a 100% false flag war. Lusitania was false. The telegram that was sent in World Zimmerman telegraph that was sent to the Mexican government right before Wilson was sworn in for his second term, where he kept us out of war, was his slogan in 2016 when he was elected. But they sent the Zimmerman program. England had cut off all of the communication telegraph cables from Germany to other places in the world. The only way they could go was through Belgium, and they managed to figure out how to do their coded messages. So they sent a coded message from England pretending to be German to the German embassy and said, you need to contact the Mexican government and tell them if they enter this war on the side of America, on the side of Germany, we will give them the states that were, quote, stolen from them by America, which would be, you know, Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, and California. Well, Mexico had no ability to do force against the United States, number one. Number two, there was no way that Germany could have presented any additional support for Mexico. So that was a completely bogus thing. But it's also been proven that the Zimmerman was absolutely 100% MI6 deep state operation. As far as World War II, excellent programs on a channel called Tales of the American Empire. And they go into FDR knowing 100% about Pearl Harbor. But one of the more damaging things was one that they just recently put out. The United States bombed Japan after the nuclear bombings. And in that particular 12, 15 minute long report, they had a witness that was in MacArthur's chain of command that said that the Japanese, prior to January 1945, had sent five unconditional surrenders to FDR and never got a reply. So they copied MacArthur, and MacArthur never replied because he was under orders to make sure the war lasted as long as it could. And so this guy that was in the chain of command when the war was over, he went to reporters at the Chicago Tribune, when reporters actually did their job,
And he said, look, this is what happened. And the reason why they didn't want the war to end with Japan's unconditional surrender in January 1945 is, number one, they wanted to test the two nuclear bombs that we were working on. And number two, they wanted to kill an additional 1 million Japanese and an additional 150,000-200,000 GIs by invading Iwo Jima and Okinawa and then the other islands. So bottom line is, once you get the war machine started, it's hard as hell to stop it.
Yes, 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 100%. And I dare say, you know, based upon my military experience and general knowledge of geopolitics, since Israel is already telegraphing there's going to be a massive war on Hezbollah, that it's unwise to make those statements in advance because you lose the element of surprise, that it's not yet. That means they're anticipating something happening in the meanwhile to soften them up. And, of course, that's going to be massive U.S. carpet bombing. We have another report about the U.S. taking troops out of Syria and Iraq, but that's really misleading. What it means, they're going to be relocated in order to attack Hezbollah and Jordan and Lebanon. So, you know, the American public is being played once again. It just envision Benjamin Netanyahu is our commander-in-chief, and you understand exactly what's going on. The United States had been exploited. In 2020, Netanyahu said that America is the golden calf. We're going to suck it dry and chop it up into parts and leave it as the world's greatest welfare state, because that's what we do with nations we hate. They're using American military forces to promote Israeli political objectives, which is exactly what 9/11 was all about, to create a pretext for U.S. forces to come to the Middle East to be used to take out the modern Arab state that served as a counterbalance to Israel's domination of the entire region, as Wesley Clark revealed in 2007 at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco, including Libya and Iraq, but ending with Syria and Iran, which, of course, is a Persian nation, where it was very successful up to the point of the intervention of Russian and Iranian troops in Syria at the request of the democratically elected president of Syria, Bashar al-Assad, where Paul Craig Roberts believes what's going on now is a completion of 9/11. They didn't get it done then. They're going to get it done now with the aid and abetting of the United States, which now stand complicit as an accessory to genocide. And with the U.S. is now bombing the Houthis. We had no argument with the Houthis. The Houthis had declared war on Israel. The Houthis were only interdicting cargo that was bound for Israel, which was in accordance with the laws of war and international conventions. The United States used that as a pretext. Again, this is Netanyahu calling the shots. We're not going to succeed in dislodging the Houthis, but what we have done thereby is make American assets all over the Middle East legitimate targets for attacks by the Houthis. And believe me, they are valiant warriors. They are fearless, and they have lots of experience. And the United States is not going to be happy with the outcome. But this fake President Biden, and you see how convenient it is to have a non-person as president. Then you can do anything you want. You can exercise his authority, and no one has responsibility because there's no real president. Joe, this is my take. Yours.
Yes, well, I would like to recommend two other sets of videos that Tales of American Empire. One of them is a 12-part series called The Anglo-American War Against Russia. Absolutely stunning. Another one that just popped up this week is Why the U.S. Army Was Overrun in 1944. Well, it turns out that after we landed on Normandy, the Montgomery and Bradley could not get our troops to advance forward because they were such terrible tacticians. So they invited Patton to come back into the war. By August 12th, he had surrounded 250,000 German soldiers on the west side of France, and he was ordered to allow them to escape with all of their equipment through a 25-mile wide path that was known as the Police Gap. Those are the soldiers that were able to stage over in the Rhine and create the Battle of the Bulge, because had he been able to seal the Police Gap in August of 1944, the war would have ended 6 months sooner than they wanted it to. So they wanted to have the Battle of the Bulge. They wanted to kill some more people. absolutely insane what we've got in the way of a government.
And let me say, this is why they're opposed to Trump. He doesn't want all these wars. He's a non-interventionist. He only wants the U.S. to engage in wars if there's a national interest of the United States at stake, which is not true in any of these engagements, Joe. So I continue to believe Trump is our single best hope. The deep state fears him, too, because he's figured out a way to eviscerate the senior executive service. Thousands upon civil servants who are engaging in policy shaping and decision making, even though they were not elected to do so by what is known as Schedule F, that's going to allow him to fire them where they've been invulnerable heretofore. So you have the bureaucrats, the elitists on both sides of the aisle, both among the Democrats and the Republicans, opposing Trump because he's actually going to conduct business of government on behalf of the American people. So everyone needs to understand what's going on here. This business at the border, why now it appears to me this guy, your governor, Abbott, is playing a role here as he's created a pretext to transport all these tanks that are clearly destined for the Middle East. I reaffirm those tanks are not going to the Texas border other than to be loaded aboard ship. And I add, Joe, given it's obvious to us, obvious to Hezbollah, obvious to Russia, obvious to Iran, I say Hezbollah needs to strike now in full force, because otherwise they're just waiting to be attacked first and be weakened by America. America's going to attack either way. Go ahead and use your forces before you lose some of them. Hezbollah is 10 times more powerful than Hamas. And between Hezbollah, Hamas, and the Houthis, Israel is grossly outmatched, which is why they're utilizing American forces to save their ass. And why, by the way, I'm told the Israeli national anthem is Onward Christian Soldiers.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's probably true. Yeah, we had the 1967 USS Liberty attack where they tried to suck us into a war with Egypt. And LBJ actually had nuclear-equipped bombers on their way to nuke Cairo when the guys on the SS Liberty were able to patch together a bare copper wire between two of their antennas that had been blown out after 3 hours of bombardment by Israeli jets and PT boats, that they managed to send out a signal over a non-classified radio frequency stating that they were being attacked repeatedly by Israel. And so LBJ had to call back the bombers, and other NATO allies said, well, what in the hell's going on? Israel's bombing a U.S. ship in order to drag you into war? That's pretty much a false flag right there. And I guarantee you, the Beirut bombing that happened in 1983, they managed to kill several hundred U.S. Marines in another effort to drag the United States in. And Ronald Reagan said, I'm not going there.
And by the way, that Beirut bombing, I believe, was with a mini nuke, Joe. You ought to check that out. I think that was done with a small tactical nuke. And by the way, Christopher Busby discovered when he visited Fallujah, because of the outbreak of genetic abnormalities, that it had been initially supposed from depleted uranium, but discovered indeed it was from enriched uranium from a new class of tactical nuclear weapons. We have reports of the Israelis using tactical nukes both in Lebanon and even in Israel itself. So the monstrosity of what's taking place here today in the world is beyond imagination. It boggles the mind.
One of my favorite quotes is from Ann Landers, and she said, the naked truth is better than the best-dressed lie. And so I hope we've exposed some naked truth for you, and even though it's unpalatable to realize, you got to realize that you've been fed the best-dressed lie your whole entire life, and it's time to revise your thinking. And the important thing is to make sure that if you suddenly wake up and have your red pill, that you do everything possible to share it with everyone that's in your circle. Because the only way we're going to defeat these people is by having mass numbers of people that are aware.
Thank you, Joe, for coming on the Raw Deal today, the first day in February 2024. So glad to have you here. Share this program widely. Spend as much time as you can with your family, your friends, and people.